As a Black gay man and artist who is continuing to become more comfortable in my own skin, I became interested in exploring the stories and histories of folks in the LGBTQ+ community. Seeing Sounds is a podcast that focuses on the works of artists who identify as members of the LGBTQ+ community and our allies. We aim to center the work of artists of and inspired by the African diaspora. Thanks for stopping by. My name is Johnny Ray Cornegay III, and I love to vote. I know that sounds weird, but I totally do. Voting is one of the ways that I know that I can make my voice heard collectively with so many folks who agree that we can make a difference in the world. If you're listening to this show, that means you should be in your car and on your way to vote. That's, of course, if it's voting time. If it's not voting season, make sure that you are registered to vote so that you can make sure that your voice is heard. Visit vote.gov for information on voting in your local area. Peace. On this episode of Seeing Sounds, we welcome artist Daniel D. Edwards. Daniel uses photography to address sensitive social and personal topics. His goal is to spark constructive conversation. His work is a culmination of multiple interests with the goal of creating a solid foundation for his nonprofit, Black Vine. Black Vine will be a platform for other artists to create and showcase their work. One of the main criteria is that the work has to be socially engaged. I spoke to Daniel about his life, inspiration, family, and art. You can learn more about Daniel and his work at blackvine.com. That's BlackVine.com. Enjoy the show. So today I would like to welcome Daniel Edwards to Seeing Sounds. Daniel, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
I'm grateful and really looking forward to chopping it up with you for a little bit. This question I like to ask to folks so that it gives the listeners just an idea about who you are. So if you could please go ahead and describe yourself and your work in your own words.
My intro, whenever I talk about myself, especially in relation to my work, is that I always premise, I premise that with saying that I'm a sociologist. I study agency, I study people, I study how we interact with each other and interact with the world to produce and do the things that we do. I've been described as an archivist, as this kind of modern day griot and holder of narratives and stories, and of memories of people, which I think is probably the best compliment I've ever gotten, and was actually really like, you know, who I am. And I, you know, I say who I am and not necessarily what I do very specifically. And I'm also a photographer, and also, you know, an installation artist too. But I use photography as my medium to talk about the things that are important to me, personally, but also as a sociologist, to the world, instead of just writing and puts it into the hands of the people, which is where it should be.
So, and what... You know, there are many mediums, there are many forms of expression that you could have and still can choose. What about photography drew you in?
I think that's a generational thing. We are a lot more visually intelligent, just I think by mere access, and to be able to create things visually, and the things that we consume visually. We move and judge by what we see faster than any of our other senses will process. And so there's always a important aspect of being mindful and intentional about visual, but how we move initially is always based off of what we see, I think. And for better or for worse, that's how we move. And it's something that's always been of interest to me. How two people can look at the same photograph or look at the same visual and come away with something completely different. And it's based off relation of the things that they have, these respective people have seen individually, to all, be surmised in this perspective and opinion that comes out of this one image that these two opposites are seeing together. And I've always found that fascinating because it's something that you don't know until you know. Like, you don't know the reaction until it happens. It's something that is a bit unpredictable observation of it all. It's something that's always something that is just fascinating to me. I mean, as a sociologist, it's fascinating to see how people react off of instinct. Their initial reaction that they can't control, I think, is the truest, in my opinion, the kind of the truest reaction, the truest form. It's it's in the same realm as fight or flight. That initial reaction is your true reaction. And it's worth investigating. I think it's worth teasing out. It's worth talking about. It's worth asking questions about. It's worth challenging.
I'm thinking through, rather. So one of the things that I know about you is how important body work, how important movement is, how important, how our bodies, work and how we just basically move throughout the world, right? How does an individual's presence for you when you're working with them, how do you use that to influence how you capture them, if that makes sense?
We talk. Mm-hmm. I think it varies from interpersonally, from person to person. We have a conversation. And in that process, a person tends to relax and kind of let their guard down a little bit, or at least feel safe enough to have their image captured in that moment. And that inevitably translates aesthetically with how their posture changes and their relaxation in the face or something like that. Or subtle changes in like eyes or smirks or something like that. But the presence of the person for me happens by actually being present with the person.
Yes.
And that has to happen by dialogue. That has to happen by interacting. Yes, I'm here to capture an image of you, but in order to actually capture that image, I have to see you first. I have to see you without this. I have to see you outside of the technology. I have to see you outside of the project. I have to see you outside of this lofty goal. Like it is an exercise in recognizing someone.
You know, so 100% agree with you, because that's just really important to me to be able to. We've been trained to behave a certain way when a camera comes out, right? So you'll see see babies do it, right? So when the camera comes out, it's like, oh, you pose and you smile and you do a thing. And I know that every time I've seen or every time I have had someone on the other end of my camera, I've always had to take that step back and be like, okay, we should talk about that.
It happens all the time.
Yep. It happens all the time. So I really agree with you. I want to go back in time a bit. I'm going to go right here. So I do want to talk about, because there's some phenomenal work, and I want to jump into that and spend a few moments there. But I want to go back in time and talk about your childhood first. So I was reading the New York Times piece about Black Outline Blue, and I didn't realize that both of your parents, you know, both of your parents were in law enforcement. And so what was life like for you growing up as a child, as a gay child, and of folks who worked in law enforcement?
Okay, so I didn't grow up with my father. Mm-hmm. I actually did at certain ages of my life. I mean, I remember meeting him once when I was really young. out of the department store with my mom. And then I didn't see him again until, you know, grade school. And I think what's so ironic about all of that growing up without my father, there was still, he was almost like this mythical creature because he was a DARE officer. So I remember one day in middle school, he came to school to have lunch with me. And in the lunchroom, he sits down, and like one of my best friends at the time was like, "That's your dad?" And I was like, "Yeah." He was like, "He was my DARE officer in like fourth grade or third grade, like fourth grade or something like that." And I had to kind of check my envy because he had made this kind of significant impact on the lives of the people around me, but I wasn't a part of that. Like, I was excluded from that. Like, he was a cop. You know, everybody knew him as, you know, Officer Edwards, right? And so I just knew him as, I knew him as the guy who I'm supposed to have this significant, you know, attachment to. Growing up with my mom worked a lot when I was a kid. She had, you know, the shifts that she had at the beginning of her career were very chaotic and sporadic. And, you know, she would, you know, work swing shifts. So mm-hmm. this kind of weird twilight hour of working in the yep. in the day through the night into the next morning type yep. of deal. Mm-hmm. And like there would be some days where I didn't see my mom until she was getting ready to leave. The whole day was when I was getting up super early with her to go to my grandmother's house to stay there while she went to work. You know, so there was a lot of that. And it took a long time for me to actually really be connected to my mother. Because, or to really build a relationship outside of, you know, this is a woman that gave birth to me and she's taking care of me. And like, you know, as a kid, you know, you want to be cuddled up with your mom. And like, my mom wasn't around all of, like, for that all the time. Or, you know, and when she was around, you know, I understand her having to play both roles and being this instrumental person in my life, but that what was sacrificed was the emotional connection to a degree. And so it's like, I get it now. And so as an adult interacting with my mom, and when I was growing up, all of the women that in my life that raised me, my aunt, my grandmother, and my mom, always there wasn't anything in the world that they couldn't conquer. With my mom, I also thought my mom was very mean. I thought she was just the meanest person in the world for a long time. And my grandmother sat me down and was like, "Your mom loves you very much and she's doing everything that she can to make sure that you have a good life." And I said, "But I just want her to be nice sometimes." Right. And I think my grandmother told my mom that and being really intentional about her presence in the home and what it means for her to come home, especially off duty, because my head. Funny story, and it kind of goes into the visuals of Black Outline Blue as far as why I do the diptychs. And her story on why she takes off her uniform before she came home is my older brother asked her why she was being so mean one day at home, but she hadn't taken off her uniform yet. She was still in cop mode. And she said from that point on, she she made a promise to herself that she would never wear her uniform off duty. She would never wear her uniform home.
Wow.
Because she was still emotionally disconnected. And that's not how she wanted to be as a person. That's not how she wanted to be as a mother. So that definitely was a heavily influence in my project. And my father has a similar story. I think ultimately what's really ironic, well, and I think something else I want to address too is that as a kid, I was just a kid.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I didn't have any concepts of, sexuality or anything like that. Okay. I was always, I was a late bloomer.
Yeah.
I was definitely a late bloomer in almost every aspect. I was the last to hit my growth spurt. I was the last to, I'm still the last to stop looking like a child, to stop looking like a baby in the face type of deal. So I was always a late bloomer. So I didn't know I was gay as a child. I didn't know what that was. I didn't know there was anything different or anything special about me. And thank God there's nobody in my life made me feel like there was anything different or portraying anything to be abnormal about me. I just grew up. I was able to kind of have the life, what I feel like is as close to normal or balanced, or not as tumultuous in that way. Now there are other crazy things that happened in my childhood and my life, but I'm happy to say that wasn't one of them. And so now, I look at my mom, she's it's ironic to me how the roles have reversed between the two of us, in that she is still very much my rock and my cornerstone, but I also see the vulnerability in her that I never saw as a kid, that I never recognized as a child. And I see a sensitivity and a softness in her that makes me want to, protect my mother. Dad, with my dad, that love is very new. But it's weird for it to be just as intense. I had to set an intention when I reconnected with my father around what it is that I wanted. And it was really simple once I kind of nailed down what I wanted. I only wanted one thing, and that was to hear his voice. I had forgotten what my father sounded like. And to remember my dad. And when we talked on the phone, I got that. And everything else after that has just kind of been icing on the cake. And it was in that moment that I hear his voice, and he's still, the still charming, goofy guy that I remember as a kid, which now I look at that very differently as an adult, because I love my dad to death, but he was definitely a rolling stone. I can see how he was able to just kind of move in the world the way that he did. But it's kind of now, as an adult, it's oh, I see you.
Yeah.
I see you. I see what this is.
Right.
But I love my dad. I love my dad very much. And I'm happy to be able to say that. I'm happy to have their stories and both of their influences a part of this one project, this one body of work that for me was set out to answer a question and to help quell an anger that I had developed over time that I realized I had really developed so intensely and so viscerally. It just made me stop, because I'm a rebel at heart and I have a smart ass mouth. And if I feel I think, and what's ironic is that the development of this, disdain for the police happened out of comparison to my parents. Was because it's my parents. Understood. Are good people. I was I know you don't have to. It's looking at facing a cop that's an asshole. It's I know you don't have to be this, because both of my parents have done or are doing exactly what you're doing, and they're not like this. So why do you have to be like this? And so that just is the irony is that the love of my parents is at the crux of this project, and honoring them is at the crux of this project. But the the hate that I had developed for other officers is also in direct, you know, contrast to that love as well, in the comparison to that love. Because it's like, I know you can do better because they have done better. And so that just would see me popping off at the mouth, and that would just be dangerous. Mm-hmm. That's right. Just going to cause more problems than it's going to solve. So I decided to not house those two things in the same heart. I decided to do something different. I decided to recognize what I was feeling and investigate why I was feeling it, and really get to the root of what it is that I wanted to know. And what I wanted to know was, how could a Black person be a police officer today? What is it that motivates a 21st century officer, to Black person, to do what they do and be in that profession? And I started by asking my parents why they did what they did as careers.
You know, that actually... Well, there's two things. One, that is so powerful that it's really this interesting, I don't want to say full circle. It's not really full circle, but it's interesting how you were able to, and insightfully be able to say, all right, listen, I recognize that this is something that I have to deal with. I need to put this aside so that I can talk to these other officers. One of the questions that I have, and I imagine that, you know, there's going to be creatives that listen to this podcast and have these ideas, but don't know where to begin. Where did you begin in terms of even getting officers interested in being a part of this? Because when I saw the outcome, I was like, this is incredibly powerful. But I also at the same time was like, I'm so surprised that these officers decided to be a part of it. So like, how did that relationship building begin to work for you?
So it started, the concept of course started with my parents. Mm-hmm. Those two conversations that I had with them helped me solidify and develop my concept, interview questions, that type of deal. From there, I was already friends with Officer Eric King. And for that, what's funny is that during school, in the quarter that started the project, I was taking two very different classes. One was all about digital stuff and working in Photoshop and Lightroom and, you know, creating human beings from scratch. And the other class was very old school, working with film, 4x5 film, and a large format camera, and developing prints, and, you know, doing all of that. Two completely opposite classes. But I ended up reaching out to Eric for my final project for each of those classes. So he just became my guinea pig for this project. And so from there, I asked him, if he knew of any other officers that he would recommend. And so what also helped is that his role with APD is like community liaison.
Yeah.
So for him to bring in the project to the precinct and say, hey, this is what, you know, this student is doing, and this is what he seeks to, get, and like his goals and stuff, and this is how I participated in it. Getting permission for him got permission for everyone else in his precinct.
That's amazing. Got it.
Yeah. So that's how that happened. And then from that point on, it's been from word of mouth. Every officer that's a part of this project is coming from a verbal recommendation from another officer. And so something else that's become essential as a part of this project is building a network of trust. I'm trusting the words of the last officer in regards to this new person that I've never met and never spoken to. I've never been, you know, on the beat with them and know how they operate. I'm trusting the word of the officer before them, and it started with Eric. It started with my friend. It started with this person that I trust. And also, another friend of mine, Donald Canna, is an Atlanta police officer too. And so like it, between the two of them, got me to Courtney Murphy, who I have to say, like, shout out, definitely shout out to her, because the vast majority of the officers that I've gotten have come from her. And it's simple. And I remember this, it was so funny. After our shoot with her, she gets on the phone and calls maybe three or four of her friends and colleagues and was like, hey, you're doing this project.
That's
this is what it is. I'm giving your number to him. I'll give his number, like, you know, to you. Be on the lookout. You're doing this project. And everybody, they were like, okay. And so,
yes,
you know, Courtney Murphy, you know, put the hammer down and was like, it's a great project. He has a really great message. Like, you're doing this. Like, it wasn't even an option. And so,
that's how.
Since then, has been this snowball thing of word of mouth.
Yeah.
And since the New York Times article has come out, like, it's gotten a lot more solid grounding and traction to the degree that the precinct wasn't like quite prepared for.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they thought I was out here playing, but
right. You like, you know, listen.
It came up again, was like, oh, isn't this a project that you did? And it was like, yeah, he was like, yeah, I participated in this like a year ago. You know what I'm saying? Like, so it's like, now it's back on their radar and now it's kind of the thing. And it's becoming even more so of a thing with like different publications and exhibitions that want to put the work up. So like this project, first off, started off as a one-off for me. I started this as a final project for one of my classes. I had something else completely different in mind moving forward in this graduate program and what I was going to do. But this project ended up going to places and taking sprouting legs of its own and really started to kind of take me along with it. It was a very short period of time where I was kind of leading this thing, and now it's kind of leading me a little bit now.
You know, that
yeah.
I'm wondering, in terms of the project itself, as you were working on it, what surprised you the most? Because I know that this part is also like surprising and exciting, right? But as you were working on it, was there that aha moment for you that solidified like, oh, this is why I'm doing this?
How many of the officers reminded me of my parents?
Wow. Wow.
In one way or another, mm-hmm. each of the officers remind me of my parents. Whether they look like my mom or my dad, or they have a demeanor like them, or, you know, any number of things. Something that they said that is a part of their story that was relevant, or, you know, that was in alignment with something that my mom or my dad said. But that has been the common denominator, I think, overall, outside of the why they do what they do, is the direct correlation to my parents as people, not even just as officers, but as people. And that's been really important. Wow.
That brings me to the Picturing Justice exhibition. So through Atlanta Celebrates Photography. This will be part of the Fence 2018 exhibition. It will take place October 3rd through November 30th, 2018. Can you tell me a bit about your work that'll be on display there?
Okay, so Picturing Justice and the Fence are two separate exhibitions. Mm-hmm. So Picturing Justice is through Atlanta Legal Aid Society. And that's a collaborative exhibition. I think that's annual. It happens every year.
Got it.
Through, you know, the leadership of ACP. The Fence is actually up now.
Mm.
My classmate told me about that.
Very cool.
I actually need to go to Piedmont Park. I guess the fence is up by the dog park area at Piedmont Park. So there'll be an artist talk I think in the next week or next couple of weeks for that, I am Picturing Justice happens first. So Picturing Justice will be next Wednesday. And I believe the fifth artist talk will be either later on that week or the following week. So I was asked to submit. There were people that I have met through networking, through like my classmates and being in the graduate program, that are in leadership positions in these different, you know, areas that, you know, unbeknownst to me, I'm just interacting with fellow photographers and interacting with people who've been in the industry for a while. And the director of ACP had emailed me and was saying, it randomly emailed me and congratulated me about the New York Times article. And we had only met in passing before that. And I was like, wow, he really took the time out to like say something to me. So I was like, that was cool. And then I saw him again in person in the building. And he had talked to me about submitting for the Picture in Justice exhibition. And then another staple in, you know, the arts and photography community, Barbara Griffin, wanted me to apply for the thing. And so I did. And that's how that happened. It was really serendipitous.
Nice. Isn't that beautiful? I love, and I will make sure, I love when that happens. And two, I will make sure that on the website, I get all of the proper information. So I'll make sure I get all of that updated to make sure that people can know how they can check out this. Because it will be by the time this airs, it will still be up so people can fall through. Daniel, thank you so much for being open and honest. Being dope. This has been,
I appreciate it. No,
you are so welcome. I'm grateful for the work that you do and, am excited to see, all of the things that you, kind of create and new things that you come up with. This is, an exciting interview and I'm grateful. So thank you.
Thank you.
You're so welcome. Seeing Sounds is produced by Static Art and Life. Our theme music is composed by Miles the 16th. I am Johnny Ray Cornegay III, and see you next time.